G Facebook page. CITR Radio 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine present The Science of Making Great Radio Workshop with the CBC's Margaret Gallagher. If you want to learn more about making radio documentaries, how to collect good audio, or just how to make your pieces pop on the radio, come out Monday, March 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. in room 2514 in the AMS Nest. The workshop is free and open to the public, but space is limited, so email volunteer at citr.ca to reserve a spot.
This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are joined by Judy Crane. Judy is the author of The Trauma Heart. We are not bad people trying to be good. We are wounded people trying to heal. Judy is the co-founder and CEO of the Guest House Ocala, which is a specialized treatment facility. And she is also a licensed mental health counselor, a certified addictions counselor, an expert in recovery from in various forms of behavior-based challenges. So welcome to the show, Judy.
Well, Marie, thank you so very much for having me on your show. I'm really, really grateful to be able to share this time and space with you.
Thank you. So I'd love to know more. We're here today to talk about your book, The Trauma Heart, but can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you created the Guest House Ocala?
Well, let's start with the fact that I am an alcoholic and an addict in recovery, 30 years in the fellowship, in 12-step fellowship. And when I got sober, I was 42 years old, and I was without money or resources, and I had three children who were 16, 18, and 19, and I created pain and havoc in everybody's life as a result of pain and havoc that had been in my life. And when I got sober, nobody was more surprised than I was. And I was able, for the first time, to really look in the mirror and be able to see myself as something more than a bad person, someone who was destined for hell, for want of a better word. And I got the opportunity at 42 to start doing some really amazing things. I think when we get sober, we begin to have an idea that we need to catch up. And we certainly, most of us get the feeling that we want to pass it on. We're asked to do that in fellowship. And so, you know, I got the opportunity to work in the field. I became a therapist, a counselor at 44, and then I went back to school and got my master's degree when I was 50, was licensed when I was 52. I started a treatment center in the forest of Ocala, Florida, in the center of the state, called the Refuge Healing Place in 2003, and I was 57, so I was catching up. And I loved what I was doing because I, for some reason, had, I think as the result of all the pain that I'd been through, the experiences that I'd had in my life, I had kind of an innate skill as a therapist. And I could, there was nobody that sat in front of me that I couldn't have empathy for or that I couldn't relate to or that they didn't understand that I knew their experiences. So the Refuge did amazing, wonderful work, 90-day treatment, intensive trauma work. And by the time I sold the Refuge 10 years later, we had had 2,500 clients. We called them refugees, and they honored that name as alumni. And they're all over the world, all over the United States, all over the world. And most of them are really doing amazing things. They learned how to live as parents, as as partners in relationship. They learn that they might have a purpose in life, and it was kind of extraordinary. So I sold that at 67 because I thought, well, there are other things to do, and I started doing more travel and speaking and training other therapists how to do the work. And then I realized that I needed another small treatment center for some people who were living maybe at a more entitled state and weren't getting treatment because they were entitled in the way that they needed it. And so at 70, I started the, I sold the Refuge at 67, and at 70, I started the Guest House, and it's a wonderful program. It's named after Rumi's poem, The Guest House, which says that we must invite in everything, the pain, the sadness, the joy, the sorrow, the good, the bad, the hurricane that comes in to sweep our house clean. And that's what trauma work is about.
Beautiful. Oh, I thank you for sharing where the name came from. I love that poem. Yeah. Now, when you mentioned you used an interesting word, entitled. So are you talking about people who are more affluent, or what do you mean when you say entitled?
Well, generally speaking, there are people, the people who come to us are sometimes young people who come from families who have, parents who have come from small means and built, businesses or careers, and they've attempted to raise their children without a lot of pain. Mm. And in doing so, without meaning to, with the best of reasoning, they've deprived their children of basic life skills. And sometimes those children are 18, 20. Sometimes they're 30. Sometimes they're 57 or 58 or sometimes they're older than that. And the circumstances of their family have created this inability to function in the world. And they've oftentimes had some of the more basic traumas like abandonment and neglect because their parents weren't around because they were so busy, or they were raised by nannies, or they were sent away to schools, boarding schools, military schools, whatever. Or they started acting out at an early age because there wasn't that kind of attachment that every human being needs. And those are the folks that come to us, the oftentimes more resistant to recovery, people who've never had the opportunity to look at the why of the behavior. There are a couple things that I say, and one of them is that we are not bad people trying to get good. We're wounded people trying to heal. And that was said to me a very long time ago when I first got sober, and it was the thing that enabled me to be able to get sober, because up to that point, I was holding so many secrets about what I had done and what had been done to me, and I was going to go to the grave with them. Because I thought that I was doomed to hell, or the people around me were, and in hell in the metaphorical sense. But when that was said to me by a woman I really respected, I realized that that I wasn't bad, and that I could tell the secrets, and that somebody else would be able to hear them, because up to that point I didn't think anyone would be able to hear them and hold the pain of them. And that's what we do for our clients. And ultimately what we are wounded. Those people who have been abandoned and neglected or sexually abused or have had medical trauma or who have had divorce in their family. And you can be the best kind of parent and do the best kind of divorce. But ultimately there's a piece of the child who is part of both parents who struggles and might have some pain around that. Those are the times when we see the behaviors like ADHD, which really, in most cases, are PTSD in children. They're experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of a divorce or as a result of sexual abuse. And what it looks like is a diagnosis if someone's not asking questions. So those people that come to us are people who've really been wounded and have layers and layers of trauma, and oftentimes pick up substances or process addictions, which are internet gaming, pornography, eating disorders, self-harming behaviors, sexual addiction, relationship addiction, those kinds of things. And so that's what we deal with. And it's a small program. There are 15 people. It's very much a family. It's a big, beautiful house with a chef that spoils them and makes the food that has nurtured them from at the best of times. We have a staff who's incredibly well trained, and all of them have done their own trauma work, and some of my best staff are people who went through the refuge, and oftentimes were the hardest clients, the people who came back three times, and they're the staff that I have that know how to love our guests, and we call them guests. We don't call them clients, because they're our guests, and we're there to, you know, to give them service, to give them our skills and our talent, and it's really amazing what happens there, because most people come there really because they want to. You know, they know that they're in pain, and they know that they have to have some resolution in trauma in order to stop the behaviors. Some people come because they're, you know, because there's an intervention, but most come because they really want to.
Thank you, Judy. Now, you mentioned process addictions, and in your book, if you go to the Amazon page, there's a little write-up, and you say that basically, it seems like your view is that anyone who has any of these kinds of process addictions, you mentioned internet, pornography, video gaming, all of that, eating disorders, they all have trauma of some sort or another. And now, in our modern age, a huge percentage of the population is addicted to the internet or overeats or engages in any number of these process addictions. And so where is this trauma coming from if so many people seem to be experiencing it?
Well, you know, I have no doubt that we live in an age of trauma. I have no doubt that all I have to do is turn on CNN and MSNBC and Fox and every other station and recognize that on a daily basis we are inundated with trauma. And, you know, my children who survived my addiction and my insanity and then have their own trauma as a result, they don't let their children watch TV when these things are happening. They're very cautious about how much they're seeing because they, you know, they don't want them to be jaded. But much of our population is jaded. And a whole lot of our population grew up with two parents working and being latchkey kids. A whole lot of our population have attachment issues because their parents are not emotionally available. And if we don't get the gaze of our mother's eyes, and then, you know, that reinforcement of what a good relationship looks like, we don't know how to have relationship, and that becomes traumatic. And there are so many people with medical issues. There's just, we pick up those tools, the iPhone, we pick up the various games, and our brain is immediately addicted. Now, is everyone who picks up the gaming addicted? I mean, a trauma survivor? Maybe not. Maybe not. But for the most part, what I've discovered is the behaviors always, always make sense when you unravel the trauma. And when the behaviors become destructive is when we're having to look at them. When I have a young man who's been gaming in his basement for a month and hasn't showered and has barely eaten because he's stuck in that gaming place. I'm looking at a young man who has the inability to have one-on-one, face-to-face relationships. I think in many ways, as much as I love the computer and as much as I love my iPhone, I think that we may be creating some of that inability to have attachment and intimate relationships because we're not looking at each other's eyes. And I don't know, maybe it's just me. But when I am creating relationship with someone, I have to look in their eyes.
Hmm.
That's where we connect.
Thank you, Judy. Yeah, some people seem to think that this generation of children now, I mean, so few children now have the ability to have a face-to-face conversation, and even young adults and from the millennial generation. And some people think that, oh, that's just part of our evolution. But I'm wondering, I mean, if people aren't able to look each other in the eye and read another person's emotions that they're clearly showing on their face, I mean, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it is, and I don't, you know, I don't know. I just heard recently, you know, I've heard it twice, actually, in the past couple of days in various programs on TV about artificial intelligence and how that's going to be what we need to be on top of immediately. I know one of them was Putin telling the Russian children he was face to face with a lot of Russian children in school, and then it was videoed all over the country, and he was telling them, he was extolling them that they needed to study certain sciences because they needed to understand about artificial intelligence, because this is what was going to happen, that we were going to become, you know, a nation, a country, a world of robots, and that we needed to know how to do that. And I don't know, maybe it's because I'm 70. I love the computer, but I'm often baffled by it. My grandchildren are tremendous with it. They are in the STEM programs, the robotics program. I think it would be a tremendous loss if they lost their emotionality, if they lost their ability to look each other in the eye. I don't see that happening for them. However, it is happening for a lot of children, that's their sole connection, the computer,
mm-hmm.
the internet gaming.
And that's part of the social life now. I mean, if you don't text people, but people these days don't even want to talk on the phone hardly anymore. It's like, oh, I'll text you, I'll email you, and
right. and I have to be honest. If I really don't want to have a conversation with someone, I text them. I mean, if I really don't want to get on the phone and be stuck on the phone, I'll text them, and that's the truth. And that's sad.
Well, I mean, it is convenient in that way, but it,
uh-huh.
yeah, it feels like, I mean, I get now, on the one hand, I crave the human face-to-face and voice-to-voice connection, but because of our reliance on technology, I also feel a little bit anxious when the phone rings.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Unless it's someone in my absolute inner circle, it's fine, but if it's someone who I don't know that well, I feel anxious. Oh, now I'm going to have to talk to them.
Right.
What am I going
right.
to say? Because with text, you have time to process it. You have time to think. There's not that immediate feedback.
It's true. That's absolutely true. It's also the place where when we're texting and when we're emailing, it, you know, except for emojis, we would really struggle with telling people what it is we're really saying. Because when you're texting and emailing, it can be deceptive into what you really mean.
Mm-hmm.
I used to have to do that with my employees because people will say things on email that they would never say to your face. And I had to remind them, you know, that it, being sarcastic on email is not a good thing. And if you're not willing, you know, to say that in person, then don't say it in email, because, you know, I find that that happens.
Absolutely. So, Judy, you've written this book, The Trauma Heart. We are not bad people trying to be good. We are wounded people trying to heal. And again, we are speaking with Judy Crane. She is a licensed mental health counselor, a certified addictions counselor, and a bunch of other certifications for helping people heal from their trauma and their addictions of various types. And you can find her at theguesthouseocala.com, O-C-A-L-A, theguesthouseocala.com. And can you tell us, Judy, why you decided to write The Trauma Heart?
Well, I've been working with trauma survivors for the better part of 30 years. And what I learned really early on was that I was working with an alcohol and drug program that was for the sheriff's department in Palm Beach County. And then I was working for a woman's program called Panda, which was pregnant and addicted women. So those women and those men in the criminal justice system were people who had committed crimes, were on the street, were either prostituting themselves, but they were addicts. And the common denominator was that every one of them had had traumatic experiences as children and continued to have traumatic experiences ongoing. And so the alcohol and the drugs were really, their addiction was a part of the soothing relief and release that was necessary to get through their life. Then I started working with women of all types in a program, and I would also be going to meetings all the time. And I would see people who were chronically relapsing on substances. And the common denominator every time was they would get sober, they would get clean, and then the feelings would come over them, and they couldn't bear the feelings, or they couldn't bear the pain that they were experiencing, or they couldn't bear the body flashbacks that they were having, and they would relapse and end up back in treatment with us again. And that was the common denominator. And back then, that kind of treatment was all about what drugs are you using, how much are you using, how are you using them, and what are you doing to get those drugs? And it was concentrated on abstinence of the substances. I started asking different questions, and this particular program I was in enabled us to keep the women for a minimum of 90 days, and often we could keep them up to a year. And we really got a chance to get into what was your family story, what happened to you, what was going on in your life when you first picked up anything. And my example is, my own personal example is, when in my house it was chaotic and it was poor and there was deprivation, and when it would get chaotic in my house, I would run downstairs and get a sugar sandwich.
Mm.
Sugar sandwich. And now when I'm speaking, I ask my audience, what's your sugar sandwich? What did you do as a child to get some relief, some release, soothing, to take you away from whatever was happening to you at the time? And what might have been happening might have been really small, and it might have been really big, but you're going to find something to get relief. And that's what happens if you happen to have the DNA for drug addiction, if you happen to have the genetics, if you happen to have the nurturing nature part of addiction, then what happens is that you pick up a drink or you pick up a drug. And I'm sad to say that it is happening younger and younger and younger now. I have people in treatment with me now who started when they were 10 and 11 picking up usually marijuana, and there's a reason, and nobody before had asked them the reason, and I started asking the reason, tell me what was going on. I had a young man come to us, and he was 32 years old, had been in treatment multiple times. And he came from a very good family, and he was the odd man out in the family because he was the one that got in trouble. And he came to us, and he had been a crystal meth addict. He'd had a run-in with the law for domestic violence because he had some anger issues. And so when he came to us, he was on Adderall, and he was on it for ADHD. And his therapist and I was the clinical director, and we worked with him together. And we said, so can you tell us how old you were when they put you on Adderall? And he said 8 years old.
Wow.
So what was happening that they put you on Adderall? What was going on? He said, well, I couldn't focus. I was angry. I was acting out. I had to be really alert. I was always watching, you know, other people. I was suspicious. And he said, and so, you know, I was acting out. My parents didn't know what to do with it, so they took me to a counselor, and the counselor sent me to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist gave me Adderall. And so he'd been on Adderall from age 8 to 32 as a result of a diagnosis of ADHD. And so his therapist and I were sitting with him, and we said, so, what happened to you when you were 8? And he looked at us, and the tears welled up in his eyes, and he said, nobody ever asked me that question before. Now, he'd been in treatment more than 10 times. He said, I was sexually abused by the camp counselor, and he had never told anyone. And yet, they had diagnosed him with ADHD, when in fact, that young man had PTSD at 8 years old. And it was unresolved trauma that just got layered and layered in so many things, because now he's bullied and he becomes the bully, and now he's the outcast in the family because they can't believe they've got this bad seed. And just a series of events, trouble in school, one after another, all these layers and layers of trauma, and treatment wasn't working because they weren't asking the right questions. And everybody was pointing the finger at your bad behavior when what his behavior was survival behavior. He was a young man who was very alert to what was around him. He couldn't focus because he was busy wondering who was going to come after him next. And I wrote the book for him and his parents and the doctors that treated him and the counselors who worked with him and the neighbors who experienced his behavior. I wrote it for other trauma survivors who've never told the secrets. And sometimes the secrets are, daddy's having an affair and I'm the only one that knows. Or there's alcoholism in the family. Or my mother and father fight and my father hits her. Or any number of a myriad of secrets that children keep in families. And that is something that is an enormous betrayal to a child, to have to keep the secrets, because they keep it. They keep it till they're, you know, until they get to us and we ask, what secrets are you holding? And you'll see that that's the first chapter, Secret Keepers. But I wanted people to understand that the loved ones around them that they look at and think there must be something wrong, there must be something bad, I want them to understand that they're not bad, they're wounded, and I want them to understand that there's a solution, and that when we unravel this trauma, we can help folks to be able to find a way to find a life's purpose, to be able to finally let go of being a hostage to their trauma and to the behaviors, whatever the survival behaviors that they have. And sometimes the survival behaviors are depression and anxiety or OCD, because that's a way to keep themselves in control. So that's why I wrote the book. And the good news is I've had several family members recently email me and say, now I get it, now I understand. And so if only a couple people get it, I'm excited.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Judy. Yeah, it seems that these days, I mean, I guess every generation has their challenges and their dysfunctions. But in this time, you mentioned latchkey kids and all that, how most households probably have both parents working. And even when both parents aren't working, there seems to be that a lot of us are in this survival mode. And so when there is a problem in the house, whether it's a problem with the spouse or it's the children acting out, there's kind of this, okay, how do we slap a Band-Aid on it so that we can get through the week?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Because there doesn't seem to be the perception of having even the time to go deeper.
Right. And oftentimes that's the case. We're so intrinsically busy surviving, just getting through the day, just getting to the next week, just getting to the next crisis, that we don't get down to the real bottom nitty-gritty of what's creating this. And so when we do this work, we make sure we get the families involved, because everybody is in their own PTSD as a result of one person's in the family. And the behaviors start to just emanate from all the family members. Different behaviors, but survival behaviors nevertheless.
And it just occurred to me, Judy, that I bet that in a lot of families, the person with the most observable behavior is the one that gets used as the scapegoat. Well, it's this person that's the problem, when really that person's behavior is probably triggered by a parent or a grandparent or the neighbor or whatever.
Exactly. Right. And often when they come to me, I tell them, I want you to pay attention. Because after they start telling their story and they start layering, you know, what the traumas have been in their life. Number one, they come to me and they said, I haven't had any trauma. If they haven't been sexually abused or in 9/11, they don't think they've had trauma. And then we start pointing out, well, bullying is trauma, or being criticized repeatedly by a teacher. That's traumatic for a child. That sets a message in a blueprint. So when we start showing those things, they're astounded. And I tell them, wouldn't you be surprised to learn that you're the healthiest person in the family? Because the acting out person is saying, yo, there are problems here. There's a lot going on. I need help in many ways, in many times. And the ones that go to treatment ultimately end up being the ones who help to change the dynamics in the family. And I was excited this week that I got to talk to a husband who we worked with for quite some time, him and his daughters and his wife. And his wife, unfortunately, is still active in her addiction. She gets a little recovery, and then she relapses. But he and his girls have changed behaviors dramatically, and they have gotten their life in such a beautiful, healthy, loving, spiritual place. And I had to tell him, you know, sometimes we lose the addict, but save the family. And in this case, the family got saved. And that's not to say that the wife won't get saved. She's just not there yet. And the good news is she's 30, so we have time. But if the family doesn't do the work, it's really difficult to send that person back to the family, because the dynamics are still there. The family often is still repeating the negative remarks that they might have said to this person who, you know, ended up owning it. You know, oftentimes I have clients who've been told their whole life, what's wrong with you? You're just not smart enough. You're not successful enough. You're just not good enough. And they have owned that to their core. And then we've helped them to recognize what's good about them, what's the reason that they're so special. To send them back to that without the family changing is just it's a futile task.
Thank you, Judy. We are speaking with Judy Crane. She's the author of The Trauma Heart. We are not bad people trying to be good. We are wounded people trying to heal. And you can find her at her website, theguesthouseocala.com. And there's so many directions that we could take with this discussion. I mean, it's just such an all-encompassing topic, because I don't think that there's a person on the planet who isn't touched in some way by trauma or addiction.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
But I really love that you, I believe you said you were about 42 when you got sober. Now, so many people, myself included, like I'm in my 30s and I have a history of trauma, and I haven't been as successful as I'd like because of all of these things. So we have this perception of, as we continue to get older and we continue to see how maybe how far we've come in comparison to where we were before, but we look at where we should be as far as, you know, having a house or having this kind of career or being married or whatever our external circumstances we think we should have by a certain age. So I love that you were able to get into finding your purpose past the point where people tend to think like, oh, well, I'm too old. It's been too long. This is just my life now. This is who I am.
Right. I had to tell somebody today, I was doing a session today, and I had to tell somebody today, I'm sorry, I'm not going to accept what you just said. She had an extraordinary business when she was in her 20s and 30s, and so the trauma has come up and grabbed her, and she's having some overwhelming experiences with eating disorder, and so, which is very shaming, and so she's sitting in her shame, and I asked her today, so I want to know, instead of you telling me all these terrible things that you believe about yourself, your external self, tell me the good things. And she said, well, I don't know. And I said, well, let's start with, you were a tremendously successful businesswoman. Well, but I really didn't do it. I had other people do it. I said, how smart were you to be able to hire the right people to make you look good in that business? You know, and I had a walker through the whole piece of that being a smart move, and that the people who came to her, because she was sought after, came to her because of her. I said, that's extraordinary. And then finally I said, and I'm sorry, I'm not accepting that. And I went through my litany of 42 to 70, and I created another business at 70. I said, so I'm not accepting that, because I'm not giving you any more time to feel sorry for what you haven't done yet, because you still have time. And I've said that to a lot of people, and I used to think it was a big burden that I had to start over at 42, that I had to catch up. But now I know that in many ways it's a real plus for me to be able to be the power of example to other people that you can do more, and that it's never too late. Not ever.
Thank you, Judy. So your the name, the guest house Ocala, is based on Rumi's poem, The Guest House. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that welcoming the pain, welcoming whatever it is that comes up, and being present to it.
Mm-hmm. And that's our therapeutic process. We create a really safe and comfortable and inviting, loving, compassionate environment, and then we help our guests to enter the trauma. And we have a process we call titration, which means going in, coming out, and titrating is going smaller and smaller and smaller. Usually that talks about doses, titrating doses. But in this case, it's titrating experience. So we go into the trauma and we experience it, and then we go out of the trauma and we help them to experience their resilience and their capacity for their talents and their skills. And then we go, and then having filled them up with that good stuff, then we take them back into the trauma and they can experience it. And as we're doing this, they're experiencing and building resilience, which is enabling them to go deeper and deeper into the darker part of the trauma. And it's in order to heal from the trauma, you really have to re-experience it viscerally, sensorily, and cellularly. So we do experiential treatments of all kinds. We do body treatments. We do breath work and yoga and meditation and somatic experiencing, which is being aware of your body and knowing what's going on in your body when various things happen or various things are said. And then if, you know, when our clients are experiencing the pain, allow them to experience it with so many of us are not allowed to experience it. Experience it at its fullest so we can have a completion, because trauma is about fight, flight, freeze. There's a chemical, cortisol, that's released when we're having a traumatic experience. And if we don't complete that process of fight, flight, freeze, if we don't get the chance to fight back, then there's an incompletion of the whole traumatic event, and we get stuck. And we also get stuck in freeze or flight. And so when we're stuck in freeze, you're going to see those clients, we're going to see the heroin addicts that are dying at unnatural numbers at this point in time, overdosing. And when you're talking about flight, we're looking at the adrenaline junkies, the people who are in process addictions that create adrenaline, or drugs like cocaine and crystal meth and Adderall and those kinds of things, because that's where they get their release from. And ultimately, when we can get our folks to fight back and experience the trauma, we're getting them through a process that was too difficult as children or as adolescents or adults to experience. And the resilience builds.
So Judy, when you say fight back, what does that look like?
What it looks like is being able to face the trauma. Look at it and say, in many different ways, you don't owe me anymore. You don't owe me anymore. And sometimes it is metaphorically fighting back on a perpetrator, saying that you can't own me anymore. I won't be hostage to this trauma, whatever it is. And it's an amazing experience to watch. Now, the only reason we know about PTSD is because of our Vietnam vets. And there is another piece of the trauma work that's really important, and it's called moral injury. And we know that because of Iraq and Afghanistan, because our soldiers were coming back with PTSD, and they were coming back with moral injury, which means when you have taken on yourself the wound and the responsibility of a behavior or an action that was taken that was outside your moral code or your moral, ethical, spiritual code. So a lot of soldiers were asked to do a lot of things in Iraq and Afghanistan that were outside their code, and they were coming home and committing suicide at terrible numbers, and they still are. And then we started seeing that with our Vietnam vets as well. Well, we see that with our trauma survivors who also have PTSD, very much like what our veterans have, because our veterans usually already have childhood trauma when they join the armed services. So when we're looking at our trauma survivors who are not combat veterans, we're looking at people with moral injury who have taken on the responsibility, the guilt, the shame, and the remorse for having been sexually abused or keeping the secrets of their family. And when we're looking at these folks who have this moral wound, this soul wound, it is much more difficult because these are the folks that are vulnerable to suicide because they believe they're responsible for what they've done. And I don't know a trauma survivor that doesn't come in with some piece of that.
Judy, it's interesting. Okay, first of all, we're speaking again with Judy Crane. She's the author of The Trauma Heart. We are not bad people trying to be good. We are wounded people trying to heal. And you mentioned the idea of responsibility and the person, who the trauma victim, feeling a responsibility for what happened. And yet, in my experience dealing working with and knowing a lot of people who have dealt with addictions and various histories of trauma, there seems to be a disconnect and a lack of personal responsibility oftentimes. So what's the difference between that lack of personal responsibility for showing up in the world and this connection to personal responsibility for, or the fault of it being on them, that this trauma?
Active addiction. When we are in active addiction, number one, we are capable of anything, absolutely anything, under the influence, capable of anything. But at the same time, there is an incredible duality of, at the same time when we are capable of doing anything, at the core of our soul, we're also experiencing guilt, shame, and remorse. And we push through that for active addiction in craving whatever it is that gives us release from that pain that we experience, whatever the pain is. And we walk through it, and we look selfish, and we are. We look unaccountable, and we are. We look sometimes like sociopaths, and the behavior certainly looks like that. And then we get sober, because that's the core at the bottom, is that the people really want it to be different, but they don't know how to be different without the substances or without the processes. Just don't know how to be different, and we have to be able to show them that you can survive walking through detoxing, walking through whatever your addictions are, to get to the place where you can deal with what it was that caused you to pick up those behaviors to begin with. Why'd you pick up the sugar sandwich? What was going on in your life that your precious little heart needed surcease, relief, soothing? And it's hard to say that about an addict who's causing chaos in your life.
Thank you, Judy. We have just a few minutes left in the show, and I'm wondering where you feel like we need to take this conversation.
You know, there are so many stories in that book. There are so many stories, and they are the stories of former clients of ours. They are the stories of therapists who treated them, therapists who were trauma survivors who did their own work. I want to say this to any therapist that's out there listening. If you truly haven't done your own work, please do it, because you will do harm if you don't. And doing your own work means snotting and crying and weeping and wailing. And our clients do. If you are families out there listening to this, please help your loved one get the right help. And the right help, if they're in addiction, is not just an addiction program. It's a program that's going to look to the core of the why your loved one felt the need to use and why they can't stop. And I promise you that there's a reason. I promise you that there's a reason why they can't stop or why they won't stop. And what kind of pain is behind that? I would invite anybody who is an EMT, an emergency room doc, a teacher, a nurse, respiratory techs, hospital people, anybody who has a workforce that they are in charge of, to look to the people that you face every day and check in on how much of what you see is acceptable and unacceptable behavior. Get to know the people that are around you and ask them their story. And there might be a softening in your heart, and there might be a change in the way that relationship transpires. And you might be the best information that anyone ever gets that there's a solution.
Thank you, Judy. We're talking with Judy Crane, the author of The Trauma Heart. We are not bad people trying to be good. We are wounded people trying to heal. You can find her at her website, theguesthouseocala.com. And Judy, you mentioned if a person is a therapist that they should do their own work. And I have a question in that, because I feel like when we are on this path of doing our work, it's easy to think, once we get to one level of healing, to think that we're done and now maybe we're ready to help other people, but there's always a new layer. So at what point is a person well enough to serve in that way?
I think a person is well enough to serve in that way when they've been willing to do the beginning work, and when they've been willing to continue to do the work. We do 5-day intensives, and I have more therapists come to those intensives, and I'm so excited for them, because that's exactly what they're doing. They're looking to their own integrity and saying, you know what, I'm asking people to do this work. I need to be able to do it myself, and that's powerful. I hire people who are interns and students, and then we train them in the work, and in the training they have to do that kind of intense work on their own throughout the training. But when I spoke to the doctors and the EMTs and the nurses and the teachers and so many people who are first responders in many respects, I'm asking you folks to look at the people that you're working with every day, but then look into your own heart, because you're being traumatized yourself every day. Every day that you're dealing as a first responder, you're experiencing trauma viscerally from the people that you're with, and that you get a chance to also do your own healing. There's a lot of burnout, there's a lot of divorce, and there are a lot of broken marriages in those first responders, because the pain is too much to bear, and they bear it. They bear it anyway. We're looking at Hurricane Harvey. Oh, my. Mm. Oh, my. That whole city is just a washing machine tumbling around filled with trauma. And you can just imagine. You can just think about those babies having water come up and being terrified, you know, and then having to get in a helicopter and be pulled up in one of those baskets. I watched that happen. And, you know, Marie, I believe with all of the terrible things we see in the world, I still believe in the innate goodness of human beings. And when something like Harvey happens, that brings to mind quite eloquently how very good we are at our core, and that being able to look inside and see what it is that makes us tick, and be able to discern what it is we want to change, is powerful. It's powerful. And people are always questioning their behaviors. I don't know why I do what I do. When you do this work, you begin to understand why it is you do what you do. And then you get a chance to change it.
Thank you, Judy. Oh, there's so much more that I want to ask you and want to talk about, but we're running short on time. There's only so much time that we have here. But
right.
I just want to thank you again for being with us today. And again, we've been speaking with Judy Crane. She is the co-founder of The Guest House Ocala. That's the website, theguesthouseocala.com. The name of the book is The Trauma Heart. We are not bad people trying to be good. We are wounded people trying to heal. And in addition to that message, is there one thing that you want listeners to take home today?
I do. I want you to know that the behaviors always, always, always make sense when we unravel the trauma story. The most bizarre, the craziest behaviors always make sense when you understand the story. Always.
Thank you so much. Well, that's all the time we have today, so thank you to Judy Crane for being with us again. The website is theguesthouseocala.com. The name of the book is The Trauma Heart. This has been Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us, focused on your own well-being and being a source of healing for yourself and the people in the world around you. I want to send you lots of love. Be well. Namaste.
All right, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna do it wrong. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay. Wait, hold on. Does this make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we. You're not even gonna last. All right. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France. Montreal. What the f***?
It's the script.
I couldn't even. What? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that, because even a fucking elf couldn't understand that, okay?
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR Production Department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
Are you paying too much for rent? Interested in learning about the future of Vancouver housing from a panel of speakers involved in the industry? UBC Common Energy, in collaboration with the BC Tiny House Collective, is hosting a documentary screening and speakers panel event on Wednesday, March 7th from 6 to 8pm. Come out for an exclusive viewing of Vancouver No Fixed Address for a chance to meet the director, Charles Wilkinson, and participate in discussion about BC's housing crisis. Reserve your free tickets today on the UBC Common Energy Facebook page.
Tune in every Tuesday from 8 till 9 p.m. for Inside Out with your hosts AJK and Zia for exciting new dance music.
Tune in every Tuesday afternoon from 1 to 2 p.m. for the Community Living Show. Join host Michael, Kelly, and friends on CITR 101.9 FM and also online at www.citr.ca for the Community Living Show, right after the morning after show.